On Sunday, October 8, 2013, Professor Emeritus Noam Chomsky joined with Afghan activist Malala Joya to speak on the issue of humanitarian intervention. This event was held at the Unitarian Church in Harvard Square, Cambridge, Massachusetts, and recorded by Chuck Rosina for the Boston Community Radio Project. Here now is Noam Chomsky.
The past of humanitarian intervention, the history is not very glorious. The future, that actually depends on us. The concept itself, the phrase, has become fashionable quite recently, but the concept is very old. In fact, just about every act of violence and aggression in history falls under the category of humanitarian intervention, at least if we believe the voices of the perpetrators. So that shows up. There is scholarship, academic scholarship on the topic, and it shows up very clearly there. So, for example, one of the main scholarly books dealing with the humanitarian intervention in modern period by Sean Murphy finds three examples of humanitarian intervention in the period before the Second World War. The first was Mussolini's invasion of Ethiopia. The second was Hitler's takeover of the Sudetenland. And the third was Japan's conquest of Manchuria and North China. Now, of course, he didn't mean that these were real humanitarian interventions, but he meant that they were the standard kind. They were claimed to be humanitarian interventions. So Mussolini invaded Ethiopia to uplift and Christianize and civilize the backward people of the country. Actually, the same phrases that President McKinley used when he invaded the Philippines earlier in the century, uplift and Christianize them. He uplifted a couple hundred thousand of them all the way to heaven. And the Philippines have yet to recover from the humanitarian gesture. Mussolini's invasion was horrendous and atrocious. Hitler took over the Sudetenland in order to, for the noblest of purposes, to end ethnic cleansing, to allow the conglomerate of people there to live in peace under the framework of the superior technology and culture of German civilization. When the Japanese invaded Manchuria and North China, their goal was to create an earthly paradise and to protect the poor people of the region from the Chinese bandits who were trying to undermine this noble project, at least those of them who survived the slaughter, a huge, monstrous slaughter. And that's pretty typical. The early history of humanitarian intervention is quite similar. Actually, one of the earliest modern cases, and one of particular interest to us, happens to be right here. In 1629, the King of England gave a charter for the Bay Area colony of the Bay Area, and the goal of the settlement was to save the natives here from their bitter pagan fate. The principal end of this plantation, the king said, was to civilize and Christianize them. And if you look up on the internet, you can find the great seal of the Bay Colony of Massachusetts, that's us. It depicts an Indian with holding two spears pointed down in a sign of peace, and there's a scroll coming out of his mouth which says, "Come over and help us." So the colonists who came were just responding to this plea from the benighted natives to please come over and help them. Well, a strange thing happened. It was actually discussed later years. Supreme Court Justice Joseph Story in the two centuries later, in the 1820s, expressed his surprise at what happened. He said that the wisdom of Providence, which is inscrutable to mere mortals, caused the natives to disappear like the withered leaves of autumn, even though the colonists had constantly respected them. It's just one of those mysteries. We can't understand the Lord's wisdom and depth. Actually, the perpetrators knew much better. So Revolutionary War hero General Henry Knox, he was the first Secretary of War in the newly liberated colonies. He described what they were doing. What they were doing, he said, is utter extirpation of all the Indians in the most populous parts of the Union by means more destructive to the Indian natives than the conduct of the conquerors of Mexico and Peru. And he warned that a future historian may mark the causes of this destruction of the human race in sable colors. It hasn't happened. Shortly after Joseph Story's musings on Providence, another one of the perpetrators, the architects of the extirpation, John Quincy Adams, lamented the fate of what he called that hapless race of Native Americans, which we are exterminating with such merciless and perfidious cruelty. Among the heinous sins of this nation, for which I believe God will one day bring it to judgment. Earthly judgment awaits, and these are not the staples of taught history, they're only the staples of actual history. On the contrary, what we constantly hear is odes to our unique magnificence called American exceptionalism. Also not unique to the United States, but very striking right now. The later history of humanitarian intervention is not very different. After World War II, there are actually a few cases of military intervention that had very benign outcomes. Actually, there are two in the post-World War II period, both in the 1970s. In 1971, India invaded East Pakistan, now Bangladesh, and terminated a monstrous slaughter of millions of people by the Pakistani army. At the end of the decade, 1979, Vietnam invaded Cambodia and put an end to Pol Pot's atrocities, drove out the Khmer Rouge, just at the moment when they were peaking. But these two examples don't enter the canon of humanitarian intervention because they had a problem. Now, the problem is wrong agency. It's only humanitarian intervention when we do it. We are our clients. And there was another problem with these two cases. The U.S. bitterly opposed them and moved very quickly to punish those who had carried out the crime of ending these slaughters and atrocities. In the case of India, that was Kissinger and Nixon at the time. Kissinger particularly was outraged by this. It was threatening to undermine a secret trip he was planning to Pakistan. He'd already set up all the photo ops and so on. It looked like this might undermine it. We know from recent White House tapes that were released that Kissinger was so furious, he was proposing to Nixon that they use nuclear weapons to stop it. What he said is that if we don't use nuclear weapons, the Russians will attack China and we'll be finished. That's the great diplomat, Henry Kissinger. Nixon was a little more restrained. He thought that mass famine in India would be enough of a punishment for this crime. And Kissinger went on to mock those who, as he put it, who bleed for the slaughtered Bengalis, the millions of them, who cares about them? Well, fortunately, Nixon prevailed. There was no Armageddon, although the United States did send an aircraft carrier into the Sea of Bengal to warn the Indians of the punishment that they deserve for the crime of one of the two crimes of intervention that actually had major benign consequences. The other was 1979. Vietnam was bitterly condemned for the crime of ending Pol Pot's atrocities. The New York Times denounced them as the Prussians of Asia. The United States imposed harsh sanctions. The United States imposed harsh sanctions and, in fact, supported an immediate Chinese invasion to punish the criminals who ended the Pol Pot crimes, and the United States immediately turned to supporting the Khmer Rouge on the borders and their attacks against Cambodia, diplomatic and military support. So those two cases can't qualify as humanitarian intervention. If you look on, there are, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the concept of humanitarian intervention became very popular, and there was a good reason for it. Prior to the collapse of the Soviet Union, every U.S. intervention could be justified as defense against the Russians. Didn't matter how ludicrous the pretense was, you could always claim defense against the Russians, so you didn't need any other pretexts. But with the Russians gone, some new pretext was needed to carry out the same policies, which of course was done. So humanitarian intervention was called upon. The 1990s were a very interesting period of American history and, in fact, general intellectual history. There has never been a period, to my knowledge, of such effusive praise for the magnificence of any state on the part of the most respected intellectuals, respected figures. So to give you a couple of examples, from the highest, most respected people, the United States was an idealistic new world bent on ending inhumanity everywhere. Its foreign policy entered a noble phase with a saintly glow, that's Clinton. For the first time in history, a state has arisen that is dedicated to principles and values, that's Václav Havel, acting from altruism alone and moral fervor, hence free to use force where its leaders believe it to be just, supported by the enlightened states who are its respectful allies. That's a small sample of a deluge, again, from the most respected and honored liberal voices, while all through the years the crimes and atrocities mounted. I don't have time to run through them. Well, there was a jewel in the crown, which the final triumph of this noble phase and saintly glow. That was the bombing of Serbia in 1999, the Kosovo intervention. There was an enormous chorus of self-congratulation. There was an international commission led by Judge Goldstone, Goldstone Commission of South Africa, which did, of distinguished lawyers, concluded that the bombing was illegal, but it was legitimate. And that phrase, illegal but legitimate, has haunted us since. Why was it legitimate? Because it was undertaken to stop an ongoing atrocities. There are a couple of problems with that story, which is uniform. It's repeated today constantly. One problem is the chronology. It happens to be the other way around. The bombing was the cause of the atrocities. It was not a consequence of them. We have extensive documentation of this. One of the most richly documented cases in history, two huge State Department publications, United Nations reports, monitors on the ground, British parliamentary inquiry, and they all say the same thing. It was an unpleasant place until the bombing, but the bombing set off the atrocities. And in fact, if you look at the indictment of Milosevic for the crimes in Kosovo, you look closely, you'll notice that with a single exception, they all follow the bombing, because that's when the atrocities took place. Furthermore, it was anticipated. The General Wesley Clark, informed Washington a couple of weeks earlier in a discussion about what would happen, that if if NATO, meaning the United States, did bomb, of course the Serbs would react with atrocities on the ground. He also informed the press as the bombing began that it was predictable that there would be a sharp increase in atrocities. So these horror stories you've seen are real, but they're the consequence of the intervention. So that's one problem. Now, that one is easily handled just by suppressing the historical record. Almost totally suppressed, richly documented, almost nothing about it. There was another problem, that the traditional victims of intervention vigorously objected. There was a major meeting shortly after of the South Summit, that's basically the non-aligned countries, about 80% of the world's population, and they bitterly condemned what they called the so-called right of humanitarian intervention, referring to Kosovo, which they described as simply old-fashioned imperialism in a new guise. Well, that one could also be handled. It wasn't reported. A few mentions of it were derided, but it did cause a slight problem. One problem was that the notion humanitarian intervention was somewhat tainted in insignificant parts of the world, namely 80% of the world, but it was a little hard to maintain. So the intellectual classes had to ride to the rescue with some new notion. And the new notion is what's called responsibility to protect, R2P. That was concocted right after Serbia to try to deal with this problem. Well, that's, I should say that Kosovo is also regarded as a precedent. The recent debate over bombing, not much of a debate over bombing Syria, did point out that it would be illegal but legitimate because international law has changed. And many commentators, even the President of France, pointed out that international law is a flexible notion. It changes as a result of actions that are taken, actions of state that set precedents. And the United States set a precedent by bombing Kosovo. Actually, this is not quite accurate. So, for example, when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, that didn't set a precedent. When the Russians invaded Afghanistan, of course, not a precedent. And what is really meant in this discussion is when the most powerful and violent states carry out an action, those who are in a position to control and shape the way history is presented, that sets a precedent. That's the reality of it. Nevertheless, there was a problem. You needed something new. R2P, responsibility to protect, came along, constantly invoked. It's claimed to be legitimate because it was supported by the United Nations, which is about half true. There was a recent article you may have seen in the New York Times by Michael Ignatieff lauding humanitarian R2P and saying we have to invoke it. There's a book about him by Derek, which you should look at, recent book on this great humanitarian. Ignatieff, like others, had to ignore a slight problem here, too. There are two versions of R2P. One of them, in fact, was adopted by the United Nations, 2005. UN General Assembly adopted a responsibility to protect doctrine. But that one has a condition. It says it has to be within the framework of the United Nations Charter. So you can have intervention to protect people, but only on the condition that it is either authorized by the Security Council or that it's an immediate response to an ongoing armed attack, otherwise as illegitimate as before. Fortunately, there's another version of R2P. That's the one that the West appeals to while appealing to the UN for legitimacy. The second one is the concept developed by a commission led by Gareth Evans, Prime Minister of Australia, who's a noted violent interventionist himself. But this one is the operative version of R2P. It's the same as the UN version with one exception. It has a paragraph stating that in the event that the Security Council does not agree on the use of force. Regional organizations can carry out military intervention within the area of their jurisdiction, subject to subsequent authorization by the General Assembly, by the United Nations. Well, there's only one regional organization that can do this, namely NATO, and its area of jurisdiction is the world. So what the U.S., the Western version, the operative version, the Ignatieff version and others, what that says is that NATO can do whatever it likes, independent of international law. Take, say, Libya. Libya is an African state. It's within the African Union. That's the regional organization. They were not silent about the bombing of Libya. They were strongly opposed to it. You didn't read it here. But they were strongly opposed. The African Union gave a series of proposals, sensible proposals, for diplomacy and negotiations to try to achieve the end of the civil strife without leading to a humanitarian crisis, as the bombing in fact did. Well, they were disregarded. They are not the kind of regional organization that is authorized to take a position under the Responsibility to Protect Doctrine. Libya, as you know, is now a total ruin. You can read about it in the paper this morning. It's such a disaster that they've even had to stop exporting oil almost entirely. Well, the fact is that whatever term is used, the accepted canon of humanitarian intervention, the one accepted here, you know, at Harvard by distinguished intellectuals, by Western powers, that's the one that authorizes aggression and violence by the powerful, whatever name is given to it. That's official history. The real history is an annoyance which is easily ignored, if we, of course, allow it to be ignored.